Welcome to Straight Talk on Health. I'm your host, Dr. Chet Salaska. Straight Talk on Health is a joint production together with WGVU in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I examine the practical application of health information, nutrition, exercise, diet, supplementation. I look at the science behind them and let you know whether it's something to consider or not. You can check out other things that I do on my website, drchet.com, and please sign up for my free emails. I recently listened to a physician rail about dietary supplements. Supplements are a scam. You don't need to take supplements. All you have to do is eat a well-balanced diet. How many times have I heard that one? You're just wasting your money because it's a bunch of snake oil. Wow. It's not that it's anything new, but being so verbose with no record of ever getting a degree or even taking a course in nutrition or herbology, those are pretty serious accusations. So where exactly did the term snake oil come from? Well, I came across some interesting research by following a line of thought backwards. In one article, the author, another physician, alluded to the idea that supplements are snake oil and began in the 1960s. As someone who is a day or two over 60, I always get a kick at people who think that life as we know it, hear that as the modern era, began after their parents were born. They criticize the Food and Drug Administration and the government for not doing enough to protect us from ourselves. We'll really never get to that point. Before we had the pharmaceuticals of today, when medical physicians also cut hair or provided some other service, people sold all types of tonics and potions that were supposed to cure diseases. They were just as bogus then as they can be today, and the government did root them out and at least fine them, if not close them down. I found articles in a 1930 issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association that described that process. Someone created a product that was supposed to be good for the blood. It was a cure for syphilis, gonorrhea, aneurysm of the heart, malaria, constipation, liver disease, sores, ulcers, and skin eruptions. Now, a bottle of this potion cost $1. The Bureau of Chemistry analyzed the potion. It contained potassium iodide, cathartic resins, alcohol, ammonium acetate, licorice, glycerin, sugar, and water. The potion was declared a fraud, do you think? And the manufacturer was required to pay a whopping $100 fine. But remember, this was back in 1930. There were several examples of these types of nostrums, potions, and tonics. These have been sold since at least the Civil War and probably before that. Some had other types of painkillers in them like opium and cocaine in addition to alcohol. They were never going to cure any diseases, just like the supplements and potions of today aren't going to cure diseases. They did help people feel better. And given that time and era, why not with opium and cocaine in them? There were no cures anyway. It helped people feel better, so be it, was the thought. As the medical community became more sophisticated and used treatments based on research and science, more attention was placed on these fraudulent cures, and they were put out of business. One thing is certain. They are the foundation of the attacks on the supplement industry today. But it's not the products that are the problem in most cases. It's what's being said about them and the claims being made. Cures is a key word. Anytime that type of word is used for any type of product in this day and age, be it supplement, gizmo, whatever, let it be. It is more than likely more snake oil than cure. The complementary nutrition field has grown leaps and bounds in the close to 100 years that have passed since those early companies were fined. What hasn't changed is what people will do to promote those products. The only snake lies in the words they say. But that still doesn't explain where the term snake oil originated. Based on everything I could find, snake oil was derived from the use of an extract from the Chinese water snake in the 19th century. Immigrants from China brought it with them and shared it with other workers working building the railroads. Now, evidently, the oil from this snake was used for muscular aches and pains. But it was high in omega-3 fatty acids, especially eicosapentaenoic acid, which has been shown to benefit muscle and joint health. Because Chinese water snakes are not found in the U.S., people made up concoctions which contained other oils and sold them as cures for anything that ailed a person. That's when the term snake oil got a sullied reputation. Here's another interesting piece of research from the Journal of the American Medical Association, albeit close to 100 years later. This may benefit those who have atrial fibrillation and are concerned about triggering episodes. It's a big deal because 1 in 3 people get AFib at some point in their life. Researchers wanted to determine the effects of caffeinated coffee consumption on recurrent AFib compared with complete abstinence from coffee or caffeine. Patients were recruited from 5 hospitals who specialized in cardiac care in the United States, Australia, and Canada. In order to be considered for the study, the subjects had to be coffee drinkers or caffeine users with persistent AFib or atrial flutter with a history of AFib and a successful electrocardioversion sometime between November 2021 and December 2024. The cardioversion is a procedure to shock the heart back into normal sinus rhythm. 200 patients with a mean age of 69 years and being 71% male were enrolled in this clinical trial. Half were assigned to the caffeinated coffee group, and the other were assigned to the coffee and caffeine abstinence group. The coffee group were asked to maintain at least 1 cup of coffee per day as a baseline. Well, what did they find? The patients were able to maintain that 1 cup per day average or more for the 6-month follow-up period. The objective was to count the number of clinically detected occurrences of AFib or atrial flutter over 6 months. Those in the coffee and caffeine group had significantly lower episodes of AFib or atrial flutter at 47% than those in the abstinence group at 64%. There were no deaths in either group, nor any adverse events either. The conclusion was that coffee drinking was not more likely to cause AFib episodes than complete abstinence from coffee or caffeine. And then they gave all the various limitations to the trial. 7 of them, in fact. 2 things they focused on was that it took over 1,500 patients to get 200 people who would be willing to give up caffeine from coffee and all other sources. We love our caffeine. They also stated that the study was not blinded and not placebo-controlled. Because they have to have a physician examine EKG proof that someone was in AFib, I don't see that as a problem. You either have it going on or you don't, and there's no fudging about it. But the placebo control thing? There's no way to blind that from the subjects, and I don't think it was necessary. Why not? What gets lost in many clinical trials is that people live in a real world with real problems and real jobs and real children. Most studies try to control too many variables. Coffee yes or coffee no is enough for an intervention. But there's one more thing that may have made the study more precise to see if there were other differences between the subjects who did have events and those who did not, to determine the presence of the caffeine metabolizing gene. I have the form of the gene that metabolizes caffeine quickly. I can have a cup of coffee and immediately go to bed. Others have caffeine at noon and won't be able to sleep at night because they metabolize caffeine slowly. With the difference in events being 47 out of 100 compared to 64 out of 100, genetics could have played a role and provided more information. While that gene testing isn't common, it is something that is available if a person wants to know. Even without that information, if a person is diagnosed with AFib, coffee or caffeine in reasonable amounts may be okay after a conversation with their physician. That's all the time I have for this episode. If you like the podcast, hit the share button, tell your friends and colleagues about it. Until next time, this is Dr. Chet Zelasko saying, health is a choice. Choose wisely today and every day.